RavingLunaticMania.com.
Sci-Fi Malady. Four obsessed fans. Well, sometimes four, usually less. Talking about what they like. Well, sometimes, usually what they don't like about science fiction. And crapping on J.J. Abrams because he's a douche.
Bad director.
No, bad robot.
Bad writer.
No, bad robot.
With your hosts, Scott Kennison.
Space prostitute.
Classy?
It's a classy prostitute, a classy escort.
Corey Glunts.
It's awful. I've screwed up the whole podcast. No!
Nick Glunts.
Well, I mean, have you guys seen that movie Looper?
And the Rage Master.
Beastie Boys with Roar! Big explosion at the moment of war!
Sci-Fi Malady. Catch the sickness.
Sci-Fi Malady. Symptom 26. Mono means one. Culture means culture. Science fiction has created untold amounts of different alien races. In many franchises, these cultures are richly developed with their own religions and unique societal structures. Two of the clearest examples of this from a franchise perspective are Star Trek and Star Wars. However, both of these two franchises have an issue. All the alien cultures are monocultures. Wait, I know I said the next episode would not be about Star Trek. And it wasn't. I reposted San Junipero, but I guess I kind of lied because the next actual new episode is about Star Trek. But we figured that since we talk about these two franchises every week, for this week, we just would not pretend that we weren't going to talk about them. Welcome into Sci-Fi Malady. I am Scott Kennison. I'm joined by the Rage Master. And today we're going to discuss the good, the bad, and the ugly about Star Wars and Star Trek's heavy reliance on monocultures. Also, if you hear a dog barking, that's because I'm dog sitting, and the dog happened to be dropped off at my house within the last 35 to 40 minutes, so she's still getting used to the place and might randomly bark or cry and whimper and run around in circles. Rage Master, how you doing?
Glad to be back.
It's been a minute. What we do? Two episodes, I think. It's been like 3 weeks since we've had you live in studio.
Yeah, I think about that much. Probably, yeah. My father-in-law was in town, not from out of state, so we've been showing him around. But it's good to be back.
You got to do what you got to do. Happy wife, happy life.
Something like that.
All right, so let's get right into this and talk about a monoculture. We have multiple examples of this to get to today, but when I say a monoculture, I mean that when you define your alien race, every single member of that race acts the same. They all pretty much adhere to the same religious view. There'll be if a race is religious, it has one religion. It won't have multiple religions to show them as a spiritual people. An example there, and we'll get to more detail later, would be like the Bajorans from Star Trek. They have their religious people, a spiritual people, and they all believe in the prophets. And that's it. They don't show a spiritual people as having multiple different religions the way humanity would. It's just one. Or you get a race that is a warrior race. Or you get a race of scientists. Or you get a race of philosophers. But you never see the actual diversity and the range of beliefs and cultural viewpoints and diversion that you would get in a normal society. And it's odd that in Star Trek and Star Wars, humanity is the only race that has a full range of different types of people.
Yeah, and I think I also want to mention here, too, that when we talk about monoculture today, this is more a thematic examination of science fiction. We're just using case studies, Star Wars, Star Trek, what we know. There's numerous examples of this. Babylon 5, I would have used it had I been more knowledgeable. If you look at gamers, StarCraft has monoculture in that the Zerg are pretty much Zerg through and through. Now that makes more sense because they are a hive mind, but then you look at the Protoss. The Protoss are, you have the Dark Templars and the Templars. That is all. There's not a lot of diversity there. The Terrans have the most, and that's only because of political factions. Otherwise, they all more or less act the same way. So we're really just picking apart what we know the best. And Star Wars and Star Trek provide the best examples of monoculture. So we've defined what monoculture is. So let's give some specific examples of that.
So let's start off with one that's probably most accessible to our audience, regardless of whether you're a fan of Star Trek or Star Wars, period. And let's start off with the Vulcans.
Oh, yeah.
If you're in Star Trek, everybody knows Mr. Spock. Even if you're not a science fiction fan, you know what the logical, cold, dispassionate Vulcan is. And from the moment a Vulcan appears on screen, I can tell you that he's going to be highly ethical, he's going to be highly intelligent, and he's going to have no emotional displays going on. If you see a laughing Vulcan, run. Something's very, very wrong if the Vulcan is laughing or smiling. Everyone is about to die.
You're essentially talking about living androids that somehow didn't get the emotional chip.
Correct. And you know how a Vulcan's going to behave. I can see a scene where I have Chief Engineer Geordi LaForge and the Federation's finest physicist debating something about warp engines, and the Vulcan barber could probably chime in and tell them what they're doing wrong and discuss the equations of warp drive in different Cochrane fields to maximize the warp engine efficiency. Hell, the Vulcan janitor might have an idea for how to increase engine efficiency that Geordi LaForge needs to act on.
Now, what about the government structure of the Vulcans? What's that like?
Vulcans tend to be, I want to say it's almost Romanesque in the fact that they have, everything is in academies and councils, and they had a higher leadership, and it's very structured within great families to an extent. The Romulans take that to its higher level. They are completely Romanesque. They have a Senate, they have a Praetor, they have Centurions. Romulans, it was taken from the name Romulus. Obviously, Romulans were right. Absolutely supposed to be space Romans.
Except when it was actually space Romans in the one episode.
Yes. The original Vulcan government in Enterprise, obviously I say original, and Enterprise is the last iteration of Star Trek, but first chronologically, was run by a high command. Their military That's right. was running the planet, and everything else was subservient to it. When you got into Next Generation and TOS, they had Minister T'Pau. Mm-hmm. And she was running things, and it turned into, I almost want to say it sounds closest to like a European socialism type of government.
I don't know. I would say because everything always tied back to the Vulcan Science Academy. So it seems like a thing of where you have the elite council that's selected, and that's it. Everyone just kind of blindly goes along with this because that's what logic dictates.
You never get too far into how the government of Vulcan is run. You know that they have different academies, they have different directorates, and they have ministers in charge of things. I get the feeling that, you know, Spock's axiom of the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few tends to me to believe that Vulcan is on a socialist type of platform, and not socialist as in communist Russia, but socialist as in the way England and the Eurozone is going at this moment. But all Vulcans act with that. All Vulcans will follow the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. They don't act selfishly.
Yeah.
They're morally upstanding. You won't see the Vulcan ever be the bad guy.
And if you are, like you said, that's a case of run. Like Spock's brother, Sybok. Except that's a key feature of monoculture is whenever you introduce the deviation, it's not only the deviation, because anything separate from this central narrative and culture and behavior is a deviation, but it's also the minority. Because Sybok. I've seen the movie 20 times.
Well, but it's also the worst movie in the entire Star Trek film franchise.
This is true, but you see that character, and it's him. It's him and maybe a handful of other hippies.
He throws the hood back. And because he's emotional, and it's the big surprise. You know, he's talking about, let me share your pain and grow stronger from the sharing. And he's clearly not the dispassionate, cold Vulcan. And he throws that hood back, and you see those Vulcan ears, and you're like, oh, crap. And he's smiling, and you know instantaneously, this is about to go horribly, horribly wrong. There is a smiling Vulcan in touch with his feelings.
Right.
Of course, he's been excommunicated from Vulcan.
That's the other feature you see in a lot of monocultures, is that the deviation is excommunicated. There is some kind of removal from society.
In Enterprise, they introduce the concept of Vatash Kator, who are Vulcans without logic. They're not welcome on the homeworld.
That's right.
When T'Pol realizes what they are, you're Vatash Kator. Like she's talking to the most hideous criminals imaginable. It would be like if someone just dropped a pedophile in a private dinner conversation.
You're a pedophilic Nazi party member, you know?
Right. That is the derision that she looks at these people with, that they're the most abhorrent, terrible deviation from societal norms possible, because they're a Vulcan that doesn't think cold, dispassionate logic is the only way to go about it, and they haven't accepted the overriding culture of their planet.
Yeah.
And the Vulcans are maybe the clearest example of a monoculture in Star Trek, because there's never any variation. Vulcan A is Vulcan B. Always. Yeah. They're always the same.
Easy to do when you make them androids, right? Now, and if we looked at the most logical, I suppose you could say, peaceful of Star Trek races, the Vulcans, the exact opposite would be
the Klingons.
Go on.
The Klingons, who need to kill everything with some type of ceremonial dagger or vicious sword that's like, hey, we're in the future. We've got laser weapons. We've got photon torpedoes. We've got all this amazing stuff. We can use the transporter as a weapon, which, by the way, aside, the transporter should be used as a weapon all the time. The ship you're fighting, their shields drop for a second. Beam their warp core out. Beam a photon torpedo into their warp core. Battle over. Yeah. The transporter's never used. Like, hey, their shields are down. What should we do? Keep firing conventionally, not beam a photon torpedo onto their bridge. No, let's not do that, ever. Okay, back to where I'm going with this. It's the future. The Klingons still need to use ceremonial daggers and batlefs and swords to kill each other, to the point that at the end of Deep Space Nine, Worf, for a second, is the chancellor of the Klingon Empire because he challenged Gowron to honorable combat and won.
I kind of get that, because if you go back to like a samurai type culture, but then someone could easily come at me and say, yeah, but samurai culture in the end had to adapt to survive. If you know Japanese history, those samurai that tried to stick to the rigid traditionalist roots were eradicated. And eventually they even got rooted out of the army altogether and had to adopt the Imperial Army standard. So even though it was more their spirit that carried on, not the traditions. So, yeah, it's...
So you look at the Klingons and everything about them is based in tradition and honor and being unchanging. Worf is the traditional Klingon, who is the least traditional Klingon you'll ever meet. But he's always about Klingon tradition. Everything has to be done according to Klingon tradition. We have to do things today the way we did 800 years ago. So they're the traditionalists. They're the warriors. And they all react the same way. They're all about honor. Talk about Klingon. Everything comes down to honor.
And
honor
fight.
Is served.
Honor and fight.
Exactly. You never stop to ask, how could a society like this actually function?
Exactly. And, you know, in Enterprise, they stick their toe in this when a Klingon scientist who's trying to figure the cure for the Klingon Spanish flu mentions that, well, you know, Klingon society wasn't always like this until the warrior caste took over. So there was this glimmer of, aha, we're going to get an explanation how things happen. And then they just explain how Klingons lost their scrunchy forehead and moving on.
And then got it back.
Yeah. So we're just going to go on and not even divulge it. So yeah, like you said, how does this society function? It should be in a feudal state.
And if everything is advancing by killing, like, there should be nonstop duels going on in the street. Like, everyone would be Andrew Jackson challenging anyone to a duel because they looked at them the wrong way. Honor has not been obeyed. I must challenge you to the death. And then, well, I mean, there's the battle between the houses. Just look at Worf and the House of Moog versus Duras. They've been fighting for three generations. So, hey, you challenged my father to a duel. Your father killed my father. I have to challenge your father to a duel. And then six generations later, our great-great-great-great-grandchildren are challenging each other to duels because of some sleight of honor in the road, because you didn't make proper obeisance to a man who was of a great house, because the Klingons have greater houses and lesser houses.
Well, like I said, feudal society.
Absolutely. I mean, it should be the most violent, there's no way Klingon society should function. And you shouldn't have the technological advancements. It shouldn't be stable enough to produce warp drive.
And even if they did, a la the Holy Roman Empire of the Middle Ages, how have they not made a number of enemies? I mean, how have you not gotten into war with not just the Federation, but Romulans and whoever else happens to be around? I mean, these are guys who, these are the kind of churlish people that walk into a diplomatic meeting, and because the other side didn't observe proper protocol that they didn't know about, I'm going to challenge him to a duel because he didn't bow and spit on the right way. What?
If Klingons were real, and Star Trek were real, every single spacefaring race would have looked and said, we got to take care of these guys right now. Or we'll set aside all our differences, we'll take care of them, and then we can go back to killing each other.
Or at the very least, let's keep a long arm's length away from them.
This would be like that moment if, like, you're fist fighting out in the woods with someone and you really hate that person, and out of nowhere a grizzly bear arrives. You just stop for a second to take care of the bear. Yeah. And then you'll go back to killing each other.
Right.
Well,
you know what's funny, Scott? We were talking about this during the prep, and there was a race you mentioned. Did they start in DS9? Or no, they started in Next Gen.
The Cardassians?
The Cardassians.
Which I love that you spelled like Kardashian.
I don't know how else to say it. I know, right? That I made that mistake as I'm writing and I'm thinking, oh man, why don't I know how to spell Cardassians?
The Cardassians are the less vile of the two races when you compare them to the Kardashians.
But when you explain the Cardassians to me, I thought, they have a smaller chance of surviving than the Klingons.
Everyone on Cardassia lives in perpetual fear that the Obsidian Order is going to kill them and their entire family because they either interfered with an Obsidian Order operation or they have knowledge that needs to be suppressed.
And why is the Obsidian Order coming after them? I mean, aside from that, why do they even have it?
There's an explanation given. I'm trying to remember what it was. The Obsidian Order prevents the government from being overthrown. It's like the CIA on steroids, that its sole job is to make sure that the state survives. And the Cardassians are the ultimate Machiavellians. It's all about the state. Everything in your life, everything you do, to the point of having children, you have them for the state. You have sons so that you can send them off to war to advance Cardassia.
So, but you mentioned that there's a lot of intrigue, backstabbing, and no one trusts the other person.
Oh, yes. It's always manipulation. It's bureaucracy run amok. And Cardassians have this death rite. If you're a Cardassian, before you die, you pick your closest relative and you tell them all of your secrets so that they can be used to destroy your enemies. Your enemies aren't supposed to outlive you. So if you have any enemies that have outlived you, you have to give those secrets away to your closest relative so that they can go make sure your enemies don't survive.
And I think I want to make a note. That's a really super cool idea. All of these are really cool ideas, but the problem is when you look at it, first of all, you can't make an entire species that operates that way. It just doesn't work. Someone is going to deviate from that norm. Because, two, consider this, in a society where everybody is backstabbing each other and trying to get the edge, that society will fail. Read anything about failed states or visit third world countries where the government is always members of the government are fighting each other, where it's complete disunity and disharmony. Those countries fail or are third world countries because the government isn't doing anything.
No, the government is existing only to secure its own power. And that's all that the Cardassian Empire does.
And within that government, it secure its own power, its own being whoever happens to sit at that throne or that conference table.
It would be like living constantly through Stalin's purges.
Yeah.
Never ending. Like, you know, Mao had the concept of a never ending revolution and thought that purging the population was important to advance the communist revolution constantly. That's Cardassia.
Yeah,
they're constantly purging their own citizens, and as I said, they're all Machiavellians. Everything is in service to the state. Period.
Right, and we got one other group in Star Trek that I personally actually there's two. Do you want to just do one or two of them?
Let's skip the Jem'Hadar, because the Jem'Hadar are Klingons on steroids.
Okay, let's go to the Ferengi. What are the Ferengi?
The Ferengi are the worst aspects of capitalism and greed run amok. They worship greed. They worship profit. Everything they do is for profit. Quark has literally sold out his own mother in Deep Space Nine to make money.
Jeez, what a scumbag.
They follow the rules of acquisition. One of their 285 rules of acquisition is greed is eternal. And when you die as a Ferengi, you vacuum desiccate your body into little pieces and sell souvenirs off to people so that you can pay off all of your debts.
Everyone's
so that
in
you
constant,
can enter the divine treasury.
Everyone's in constant debt?
Yes. If you are in debt, you know, but even if you die, you still vacuum desecrate yourself and sell it off so you can make even more profit in death.
Even though you're not going to see a dime.
Correct. Well, because you have to have so much profit. If you die a debtor, you will not enter the divine treasury. They literally worship profit.
So profit is a god.
You can only get into heaven if you die making a profit.
So it's Valhalla, but by acquiring money. Instead of dying with your sword in battle, it's dying with your bank account in the black.
Correct. The leader of the Ferengi Alliance is the Grand Nagus, but he's the financial leader. Boy, that doesn't sound currently familiar of anything similar of anything going on right now. But
well, Star Trek is a social commentary, so even though we're using these monocultures, complaining about it just a tad, they are aspects of human culture, which we'll get to in a minute.
Absolutely. That's you're going to talk about that a lot, but essentially, the Ferengi are greed run amok, and I would say the Ferengi are supposed to represent the worst aspects of American culture. When they're first introduced, Data defines them as Yankee traitors.
Wow.
And Riker says, oh, throwback to my own ancestors, because he's the American on the bridge who identifies as an American. Data says, well, no, it's supposed to represent the worst aspects of American capitalism. And that's the Ferengi. The Ferengi show you what happens when you set everything aside in the name of making money. You can be executed on Ferenginar for abandoning a contract.
Wow.
Yes. If you don't fulfill a contract, you must either kill yourself or you will be banned from Ferengi society. If you are a Ferengi employer and you allow a union to occur, you lose your Ferengi business license and all of your accounts are seized.
Jeez.
No rights for labor.
So they're bluntly hitting you on the head with this.
At one point, Quark's brother Rom says, the Ferengi don't want to overturn the rules to make things better for labor. We want to find a way to become the exploiters of labor. They come right out and say, I mean, that's as hit you over the head with a hammer as it gets. So they absolutely are. They're supposed to represent Andrew Carnegie and John Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan.
Early on, not later on, when they decide to give out their money to be philanthropic.
Correct. And you know what? I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole, but I'm not going to redeem Andrew Carnegie for giving his money away late in life after he had spent his whole life telling people, hey, you lost a finger, you got 9 more, get back on the line.
Well, that's a rabbit hole we're not going to go down. But the point is,
they are the worst aspects of capitalism brought on screen.
You know, and that's funny that you say that, because I remember, too, when my dad and I would talk about Company X in America behaving badly, doing everything at the expense of profit, or, you know, some politician making a policy in the favor of profit at the expense of society, my dad just would shrug and say, well, that's Ferengi economics for you.
And that's where we're at right now. And if you want me to expound upon this, go to any of my quick rants, because it's pretty obvious that my theme here is that business runs America. And in the Ferengi Alliance, the government exists to further the interest of business. All of society exists to further the interest of business. And that's the Ferengi monoculture. In everything you do, you should be making money or furthering the interests of those who make money.
You know, and there's one final point I want to make. Scott, you mentioned that when we were talking before the show, that the women are supposed to stay home, be little lammy lambs in the kitchen, and never wear clothes.
They are not allowed to wear clothes. You can be arrested as a woman for wearing clothes.
It reminds me of a guy. It's like the Pornhub version of 1950s America. That's what it really reminds me of. 1950s, the woman stays home, and while we're on the topic, she has to be naked all the time.
Absolutely. She's not allowed to leave the planet. She's not allowed to have a job. A woman who makes money can be arrested and all of the profit of her male relatives seized, even if it wasn't what she made?
Now, let me make a note. Of course, in the 50s, women weren't arrested for having a job or anything, but the social expectation, it's the social expectation that existed in the United States taken to an extreme that is just awful.
Which absolutely is the point of the monoculture. But before we get into that, turn it over to you, Rage Master, for your thing here, Star Wars.
Oh,
where do we see examples of this in Star Wars?
Oh, plenty of things in Star Wars. I guess I'll start with the Jedi and the Sith. The Jedi and the Sith may not be an alien race, but they are the two major good evil entities in that series. And the Jedi, I've said it before, I'll say it again, like any good myth, the Jedi are good, the Sith are bad.
And they each definitely qualify as their own cultural entity. They are
absolutely
a culture. Absolutely. As clearly as any race in Star Trek is, or as any religion on Earth is, they're clearly their own unique defined culture.
Well, they have their own codes and creeds. In fact, later on iterations in the original canon, there was the Lost Tribe of the Sith, a ship that crashed onto the plant homeworld of Kasheri, and they became the dominant culture, the dominant civilization, dominating the native species, the Kasheri. I think that's how you say their name anyhow. But these guys, all the Jedi, now there's different slight variations in Sith and slight variations in Jedi, how you practice using the Force. But at the end of the day, it all serves the greater code, whatever that may be. With the Jedi, there is peace, no emotion, that sort of thing. So when you talk about a Jedi, you could pretty much guarantee that they're going to behave this way in this situation. When Anakin was trying to act a little differently, all the Jedi thought, whoa, 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 Anakin, you can't go out and kill and do that. That's not the Jedi way. Or if a Sith shows mercy, whoa, 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 what's wrong with you? The presumption is, you better have a good reason to have shown mercy. Are you planning on manipulating them down the road? Are they going to be a pawn in your scheme? Is that why you showed mercy? No? Then why didn't you kill them?
To use a gamer term, if you had an alignment, all Sith should be chaotic evil.
Lawful or chaotic evil, and all Jedi should be lawful good or chaotic good. Period.
Exactly.
That's it. They can't be anything else.
The Jedi are supposed to act from a selfless perspective to enhance the greater good, and the Sith are supposed to be selfish every action, self-serving.
Is that good or bad? We'll get to that in a moment, but this is a mythological trope, so that's one of my biggest complaints now about modern Star Wars, when they try to introduce gray areas. Because really, too, the Jedi do introduce kind of a gray order. If you read the original canon, there was the book, the comic series Legacy, where the Imperial Knights show up. And the Imperial Knights were able to tap into both sides of the Force to defend the Emperor. But that was an aberration. Typically, the Jedi are good or bad. There's no middle, I know how to use the Force, and I'm just going to go grow crops the rest of my life. Even if you're in the agricultural corps, you're a good Jedi. So that's the biggest example, I'd say. The next would be, I'm going to skip over to Rodians. If you're not familiar what a Rodian is, episode 4, Greedo, the guy that Han shot first, that would be a Rodian.
And Han shot first.
We all know it. So Greedo, if you ever pick up any information about Rodians, especially the original West End Games Star Wars material, there's a little blurb in the descriptions of Rodians, a story factor. And it says, almost all or most Rodians are bounty hunters. It doesn't say all. I can't quote exactly, so if you want to comment about that, please do. But the implication is that a majority of Rodians in the galaxy are bounty hunters. And it even goes to the point to say most Rodians can't leave their planet unless they're bounty hunting. So, and in the book The Planet's Guide for Shadows of the Empire, they introduce different clans, but again, they're all bounty hunters at the end of the day. So it begs the question, how did this society flourish if all they're doing is bounty hunting?
Right, because who's committing crimes for the bounty hunters to go bounty hunt?
Right.
Just so, a society of Dog the Bounty Hunter walking around everywhere.
Yeah.
I can't imagine a worse place to go live.
Right, and honestly, right now, if you're thinking, gee, we did a little bit more detail on Star Trek, that's because Star Trek, typically being a social commentary, even though it's a monoculture, they try to flesh it out a little more. Star Wars, we'll get to this in a moment, why they have monocultures, is going to be much more simplistic and straightforward.
And secondly, I have 700 live-action episodes of Star Trek to draw from, whereas I have eight live-action episodes of Star Wars to draw from. You don't have nearly the depth and breadth of material.
That's right. Well, you do.
If you include the books, and if we want to go down the rabbit hole of the expanded universe, and that's your drinking game today when I say rabbit hole, because for some reason I'm really on that term today. If you want to go down that sidebar, we could do that, because the Rage Master and I have both spent a lot of time in that expanded universe. Me not as much as the Rage Master, but I think we might lose a lot of people in the conversation. Yeah, so we want to keep it accessible. And now we're really just talking about the show and the planning of the show. So we need to move back forward.
So let's get back. Yeah. So the point is, if there's more material in Star Trek, and Star Wars tends to keep it simpler, but there's that. Then there's the Wookiees. Wookiees are basically tree dwellers that are really good mechanics, fly into rages, and have a life debt. Not with everybody, but you know, they have the concept of life debt.
I always kind of saw Wookiee as Star Wars' Harry Klingons.
No, because they're not warmongers. They don't go out to make war. They don't have an honor code about them like the Klingons do.
We got a life debt.
They do, but that's if you save their life. They're good paying
point.
Respect.
Good point.
It's more that they all live in trees. They do have an honor point that you can't use your climbing claws in combat. And like I said, there are a lot of more good mechanics and engineers. That is all. I mean, when they get into their berserker rage, they get into their berserker rage.
Wait a second. You're forgetting the fact that it is a rite of passage on Wookiee Christmas for Grandpa to sit around watching weird porn on his virtual reality goggles while the kid's in the living room watching Grandpa.
And that's the
Mom,
kid,
Mom, what's
by
Grandpa
the way?
Doing? Don't worry, Grandpa's just pleasuring himself over there to this virtual reality porn.
Hey, okay. Usually I'm the one removing the family-friendly part, but Scott just did that.
Seriously, and that is from the holiday special that you can't find because George Lucas rightfully has tried to eliminate it from the face of the earth.
Ah, but he has failed. In fact, I think that'll be a Christmas episode we do because I do possess the holiday special, in fact.
If you haven't watched the holiday special,
it's on YouTube.
The first 18 minutes of this, which is Chewie's family speaking to each other in Wookiee with no subtitles, that's not an error. It's not a parody. It's not a gimmick. You're watching the right thing.
George Lucas
released that for profit, and the first 18 minutes is Chewie's Wookiee family talking to each other in Wookiee, going about their daily life with no subtitles.
By the way, George Lucas had nothing to do with it. So if anybody says, yeah, that's Lucas's bad idea... No, the bad idea was to let someone do that and just kind of say, sure, make a holiday special. But we're getting way off the beaten path.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I guess the final one I'll talk about are the Hutts. Not a lot has been said about the Hutts in the movies. Actually, there's only one thing about the Hutts said in the movies, and that is in episode one, you can't take Her Highness there. The Hutts are gangsters. That's it. They're gangsters. There is a Hutt Jedi in the book Planet of Twilight. But if you follow the Rage Master protocol, that didn't happen, la la la, there is no such thing. Because in the original Star Wars books, Hutts were very good at seeing through force illusions and trickery. They were resistant to it, so therefore they couldn't really be Jedi. Until Barbara Hambly decided that a Hutt with a lightsaber was a good idea. And so, no. It is a bad idea. A giant slithering slug with a lightsaber. I'm not worried about the lightsaber. You could just walk around him. I'm worried about him falling on me. What?
I'm just cracking up. I'm trying to think of this like this Hutt Jedi going through his sword practicing.
Yeah, with his stubby little arms.
It's a 2,000-pound slug with Tyrannosaurus Rex arms. You... All you have to do to not get killed by it is stand 5 feet away from him and run around and step on its tail.
Yeah.
You have to watch the tail. The tail is more dangerous than the lightsaber.
Right. And I know huts do combat, but they're huts. They can keep up with each other.
Listen, hut combat is fine because it's two huts fighting each other. They're going to move that slowly. A hut...
It's like a sumo wrestle. It's a sumo wrestling match.
No one's fearing the hut warriors. You can outrun them pretty easily. Well, they're not strong. Leia choked Jabba to death, and that was Leia with a chain.
Yeah.
For all of Jabba's mass and girth, his little spindly arms couldn't pull that chain back from a 110-pound Leia.
Right. So, but the idea, the basic point is, they're gangsters. I could give more detail than that, but it's really not worth it because at the end of the day, it all comes down to the vast lot of them are gangsters. They are all Don Vito Corleone.
And I'll be honest, probably had to give a little more detail on the Star Trek side of it because Star Wars is more unashamedly creating monocultures.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're not developing. The Hutts aren't developed as much as the Ferengi are. The Wookiees are not. Wookiees. Are not developed as much as the Klingons. Klingons. It's a Klingon. Their pronunciation changed over the years, too. None of those cultures in Star Wars, with the exception of the Jedi and the Sith, are developed near as much as the ones in Star Trek. Even the Jedi and the Sith are
White Knights, Black Knights. That's it.
Incredibly deeply developed either.
They're the Samurai, Arthurian, White Knights, and Black Knights. That's all you need to know. In fact, it goes down to the... Now they're trying to come up with explanations why someone has a lightsaber color, this and that. The Agent Crystal is bleeding because it's corrupted by the Force. Blah, blah, blah. Two people with too much time on their hands.
This is people who don't have a story to tell, but let's tell a story.
Yeah, let's tell a story and make it up. And so,
need to write a book.
Scott, you mentioned... you know, that Star Wars is a little bit more simple on the monoculture. And if you'll let me, I can explain why that is. There's two key reasons that I find. One is Star Wars is a myth. I keep hammering this home, sci-fi sickies. It is a mythology set in space. George Lucas has said so himself. He used the word family saga because it is also that. But at the end of the day, it's a sci-fi family saga, a mythological family saga set in space. There is no more need to develop characters, because the outlying characters, because they just are not, they're tertiary to the main family. You develop the main characters. You develop the Darth Vader. You develop the Luke Skywalker, the Han Solo, because they are the central characters. It's their story we're telling. Where even in the new movies, the central narrative is going to be about Rey. You develop her and the Jedi. We don't need to know about why Maz Kanata's alien race lives that long or why they may or may not act this way. Who cares? Butthole Eyes is there to serve one purpose, and that's have Butthole Eyes somehow have Luke's lightsaber for reasons unknown and just have all the answers because I'm too lazy to come up with any other reason than that.
New Yoda, the wise old character with all the answers,
Butthole Eyes,
is supposed to be new Yoda. I like that. That we might hear that again in a few minutes, like 15 or 20 from now. So we've named a whole ton of examples here.
Oh, yeah. But
go ahead.
Yeah,
you had another point on why Star Wars does this.
One is because it just the mythology tends to not flesh out all of the tertiary characters.
You could lose the very simple message you're trying to tell in a mythology by doing that too.
And that leads to the second reason. It's just plain easier. It's just plain easier to develop the central story. And then if you want, for marketing purposes, for selling books, you flesh out as you want. I mean, the Bothans. The Bothans were mentioned in Return of the Jedi. Many Bothans died to give us this information. Then we heard nothing about them until the expanded universe started. And if you read about the Bothans, they're basically the Cardassians. They're espionage. They used to have lots of war, but it became difficult and not profitable. So they just do espionage. They don't kill each other, but they just spy on each other left, right, center, which of course begs the question, how does that society exist? The clans are always against each other, but you know, you can flesh that out when it's economically worthwhile, but otherwise you don't need to know that the Bothans are spies, just that they found the Death Star plans. That's it. Good enough. Move on to the narrative. It's easier.
Yep. And that leads us right into where we're going next with this is, why do they do this? If, as we pointed out, it's so completely unrealistic for an entire culture of people or an entire race of people to all behave the same and to have no variance within that race or culture or even religion, period, any grouping of people, to think that everyone will react the same because they identify as X, if it's so unrealistic, which it is, why do they do it?
Well, I gave you mine. One is, aside from Star Wars reasons, the key, one of the keys that plays in every time is it's easier to write. At least I give a reason, extra reason for Star Wars, the myth part, but also easier to write, no, even for Star Trek.
It absolutely is, because when you're doing your character development, if you're writing, you've got to sit there and say, okay, character John Doe, who is he? What's his background? Why does he act the way he does? How do I get this across to the audience that he's going to act the way he does, or that she's going to act the way that she will? And so when you have a pre-established monoculture, you say, I need a cunning, devious, yet honorable and sensible person to be my villain in this story, Romulans. They're cunning, they're devious, they're secretive, they're paranoid, but they have their own code of honor and can be reasoned with and rationalized with. Okay, I know what I need, a Romulan. And then when I put the Romulan out there, the audience already knows why they're going to act the way they're acting, because they're a Romulan.
Right.
I need a warrior. Okay, I've got Klingons.
Right. I mean,
and I already know, oh, Klingon, that guy can kill 10 humans on his own.
Right. Why spend reams of paper on developing a, let's say, 26 country planet of Romulans that you're only going to use one country, and then it might muck up the regular storyline because, okay, I've got the Romulan antagonist, but what about the other 25 nations that are different?
Plus, you've got 48 minutes to tell a story on TV, and you don't have a lot of time to develop a character and to make their motivations clear to the audience. So a monoculture serves a point there. You almost have to have monocultures in that regard to be able to tell your point quickly. And in a movie, you got 2 hours of screen time. Is it easier in some cases, especially in a franchise, to have a monoculture established so you know character A acts this way because he's from race B?
Yeah.
And
Butthole Eyes is going to know everything because she's lived forever.
Correct. And you know this, and it's established. Or in Star Wars, you know, you've got a good mechanic warrior, and hey, it's a Wookiee, because we know that.
Yeah. Anal Eyes is going to... Everyone in the Anal Eyes race acts that way. I just like saying that.
You, for some reason, man, I thought I was getting the family-friendly rating removed, but I think
I'm using. I switch gears to use the medical terms. But, you know, you start... So that's the easy one, and I mentioned one for Star Wars. Scott, you had one for Star Trek, another reason why they do monoculture.
Yeah, and this is a smarter reason to establish monocultures. Star Trek has always used the aliens to show you the bad in current humanity. So you want to see what's bad about warhawks and a hawkish society and people who think that honor has to be defended at every turn and can't let a slight go and are quick to anger. There's Klingons. We'll show you what's wrong in Klingon society and that aspect of it, and we'll reflect that. That's the reflection of what's wrong in human society. Ferengi. We said Ferengi represent the worst of American capitalism, and that's true. And so every time you need a Ferengi and you need to show the worst aspects of American capitalism, there's a Ferengi. And it makes it a simple writing device. At the same time, you can show the good aspects of humanity through these aliens as well and say, look, here's an admirable quality of American capitalism. It creates a society that has a lot of wealth and a high standard of living. But here's the downside to that American capitalism run amok, hitting you clearly in the face with the Ferengi. Romulans, they represent the paranoid, secretive, bureaucratic side of our government that we try to make sure is under control. The Cardassians represent even further to that, which is when your paramilitary governments get completely out of control, a la the CIA in the 60s, assassinating world leaders and installing governments. That, to me, is one of the big uses Star Trek has of a monoculture is they're going to sit there and show you the flaws in today's humanity through the aliens so that they can present a fully enlightened and advanced and developed humanity and say, this is what a fully actualized, so to speak, human society would look like, and that's what our human characters will be to show you where we are today and what we have to overcome to get there. Here's the aliens.
we use the word microcosm. Star Trek is a microcosm, and so you're kind of forced to define the aliens monoculturally to make your point. Just real quick question, the Ferengi, weren't they like sniveling cowards also?
They're not very good in battle and combat. Okay. Originally, this is crazy. For Next Generation, they're originally supposed to be the big bad villain. Mm-hmm. The big bad villains in TOS were the Romulans and the Klingons, depending on what season you were in.
All right.
The Ferengi were supposed to be the 7-year enduring big bad villain, the way the Cardassians were in Deep Space Nine and ultimately the Dominion. They didn't screen test well. If you go back and you look at the first episodes of the Ferengi, they're walking around. You can't see me, but they're like making cat claws and hissing, you know?
Yeah,
and it came off terribly. And then the Ferengi go through a bunch of changes in Next Generation, and until they get fully developed into who they are in Deep Space Nine, and they can't fight. You find a Ferengi mercenary in Deep Space Nine at one point, and he's terrible. But he's an odd Ferengi, and he's also like excommunicated from society because he likes to do knife work. And he's terrible at it too. He'd get destroyed by, you know, a grade school level Klingon. But at any rate, yeah, the Ferengi use their negotiating skills and their business skills to buy their way out of trouble.
Oh, okay. Plus, they had butt heads. They had butts on their foreheads.
Absolutely.
So that goes down. Ultimately, it seems to me, as we're going to wind it down, it seems to me that is a monoculture bad? Well, no, if you're using microcosm or mythological writing. Because if you're using mythological writing, you're really trying to hone in a character or a point or a group, and that's the story you're trying to tell. Everything else is serving that point. And you're going to have to use a monoculture. You can't make reams of paper because it just gets in the way. And for a microcosm, well, each actor, each part is representing one aspect. So if you think of the story as something like a body, well, a finger is a finger. An index finger is an index finger, okay? Your index finger is going to be that way. The other one is just the other side. It operates on the same principle. And that's just the way we got to do it. We can't get into hyper detail. So I'd say in that regard, it's good if that's what you're going for.
I think there's positive aspects for it, and I'm not going to rehash them there, Rage Master, because you've said them very well. I also think it's something we should revisit. I said in the intro that Star Trek and Star Wars have a monoculture problem. And for Star Trek especially, it's a progressive TV show. It's heralded as a forward-thinking, open-minded show that shows you the best humanity can become, what we evolve into. And so if you're trying to send this message, as you did in the original Star Trek series, that race doesn't matter, and you have a black woman on the bridge, and you have an Asian man on the bridge, and a Russian man, and that we've overcome nationalism and racism and misogyny and sexism, then what message are you sending, though, when you can judge every Klingon who appears on screen by the fact that he's Klingon, or you can judge every Vulcan who appears on screen because he's Vulcan? In one episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, we get a Ferengi scientist. Like, everyone falls on the floor, and even the Ferengi goes, yeah, I know, Ferengi scientist is an oxymoron. I'm not about profit. And, like, everyone's jaw is hitting the floor, and, like, he's a heretic. And what message are you sending? Are you sending that you can judge every white person by the fact that he's white and know how he's going to act? That you can judge every black person on the fact that he's a black man or a black woman and they're going to act that way, and that stereotypes are valid? I mean, is this the message? Star Trek comes real close to treading this line, and I'm going full social justice warrior at the moment, but in today's day and age, when we really should be, I hate the phrase today's day and age, should you ever be teaching and reinforcing even passively this notion that you can apply stereotypes and rely on them? And Star Trek is influential. I'm not going to lie. Star Trek influences the way I think. It's always influenced the way I think.
Nerd!
It has. It's formed some of my moral foundations. I mean, some of it you really can rely upon, and you can look and say, I would like to behave this way, and here's a good lesson I learned from life, from Star Trek.
Dork!
Absolutely. But I'm not going to lie about it. I'm not going to deny it. But then that makes you wonder what else is passively being reinforced from Star Trek in my thought process and my worldview.
Only a dweeb would know.
But this being what it is, this is Star Trek's monoculture problem. This is Star Wars' monoculture problem. While it's an easy writing method to use to get your point across, there has to be other ways to use the aliens to portray the flaws in society than making them all act the same. There has to be a better way to, from a mythological standpoint, have a character accomplish the goal they need to in this instance without explaining their whole culture. So the next time you need someone to do something else, it can be the same race that it was last time, and that's just a variation on that culture. Star Trek wanted to make a case about Bajorans and spirituality with Deep Space Nine and really examine religion, and they did it by creating a race that had one religion. The entire race had one religion except for a few cultists who worshiped the Pa'wraiths, and all Bajorans worship the prophets. What are you saying? That all religion is the same? Is that the message you're sending? And some people are nodding, going, yes, all religion is the same. It's just a different spin of the same tune. A religious person would almost want to challenge you to a fight for making that assertion.
Well, Poindexter, I wouldn't charge anyone to a fight, but I would take issue with that statement.
I'm sorry, a Klingon religious person would challenge you to a duel to the death.
Ah, there we go.
But do Klingons even have religion? No, because Klingons killed their gods, and every Klingon knows that their gods don't exist.
I will kill it.
No, that's true. Klingons killed their gods.
Uh-huh.
Yes. But at any rate, this is where I say the monoculture problem exists, is that you're reinforcing this idea of the validity of stereotypes.
So we can agree then that it is typically a tool of weaker story writing, unless you're trying to be microcosmal or thematic in mythology. It's kind of a weak. I don't know if I'd say weak.
I'd say it's an overly relied upon writing method
that can potentially create weak writing
that works, but can lead to lazy writing. It can also lead to some very high level smart writing.
Yeah,
it can be used to make very good points. I'd say the drawback to it is a passive drawback in that it passively reinforces negative things.
So then it sounds like one has to tread carefully when they're using a monoculture, because it can easily become weak story writing. So I guess that's our take. It's good when it fulfills these purposes, but also has a very negative side and must be used cautiously.
Hence the real monoculture issue. You can use a monoculture for very good storytelling or very weak storytelling. As you said, I'm not going to say it doesn't lead to weak storytelling, but this is the real monoculture problem. On one hand, you can use it to tell very high level progressive stories about where humanity needs to go and how it needs to get there. On the other hand, by the sheer act of using a monoculture as the vehicle to tell that story, you're reinforcing the crap that keeps us in ignorance at this moment.
Right. And this goes on in other things. Babylon 5, StarCraft. StarCraft definitely uses it. But I'd say with StarCraft, it's a video game and it's got a great narrative, but you're kind of stuck relying on it. And it is a little weak because the writing is focused on this story element. And so all Protoss are this way. All Protoss are interested in fighting for holy war. They're all looking for the Zelnaga. Maybe. So what do you guys think? What do you sci-fi sickies think? I was going to post some good sci-fi. I was going to mention some sci-fi authors who do not follow a monoculture and do it well, but we're a little out of time. So look to Twitter. I'll post it there.
Find Ragemaster at Ragemaster37 on Twitter. Give him a follow. Find me personal Twitter at Scott2824. Find us at the show on Twitter at Sci-Fi Malady. Find the station at Raving Lunatic Media. I've given you way too much stuff to remember. If you want to contact us, email us at contact@ravinglunaticmedia.com. That's it for this week. I would tell you that we're not going to talk about Star Trek or Star Wars next week, but I know that my word means nothing at this point. And we're going to talk about it anyway, no matter what show we do or what the topic is. So that's it for this week. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.
Buttheads. Butthole Eyes is going to know everything because she's lived forever. Everyone in the anal eyes race acts that way. I just like saying that.
Raving Lunatic Media! .com